promise, this is me, co-host Adam, talking on the microphone. It's safe to say that the week and the weekend has completely broken me, and I thought that it wouldn't really be a fair reflection on some of the week if we just podcasted on Wednesday with voices in full bloom and not have to hear some of the suffering that my throat is currently going through after a night and a week hosting the Seahawks. All the screaming at the game on Sunday, maybe washed down by one or two too many vodkas across the week, has led to this position, and I wouldn't want it any other way. It was a fantastic week, brilliantly hosted by the UK Seahawkers Committee, incredible times at the Barrow Boy pub in London Bridge, a fantastic evening on the Saturday Revolution, and topped off by an amazing game day in which we absolutely throttled the opposition and gave our fans so much to cheer about. It was truly brilliant, and I can't wait for us to do it all over again, although my voice may think otherwise. Go Hawks forever!
This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
If Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when, if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks!
Welcome to the Pedestrian Podcast, the only and official UK Seahawkers podcast. Today we will get into everything from last weekend at Wembley and in London, with myself, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan.
Hi, bud. How are you doing?
Not too bad. But before that, it is all about this man.
First of all, let me say that I am thrilled and honored to be part of maintaining the proud tradition of professional football in Seattle.
He made a commitment, not based upon a financial reward. He based on the commitment to this community.
Sports really brings a community together. And given my long history with the city, I felt like it would be a great thing to keep the team in Seattle.
When I said yes to help save the Seahawks, I meant that I do my part in building something for the future, personally and financially. If you vote yes, I'll do what it takes to make the new stadium and exhibition center a success. I stand by that commitment. But if you say no, that means no for me too, because I'm not going to do this without you. When I said that you'll have the final say, I meant it. Together, we can leave something for future generations.
One of the best things about it was seeing how gratified Paul was, how proud he was holding that Lombardi trophy.
It's kind of like you're having a sunrise in your heart. You just feel a real satisfaction and joy that's hard to describe. There's an unusual bond between this team and this community that you rarely see in sports. The players can feel the love from the public, and I think the fans can feel that connection with the players too.
I think that Paul likes to inspire people to try to leave the world a better place.
That is Seahawks owner Paul Allen, who died suddenly last Monday at the age of 65 due to complications with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He only announced 3 weeks ago before that the illness had returned after beating the disease in 2009. His death was and is a stunning blow to sports fans in the Pacific Northwest, from Seattle all the way down to Portland. The co-founder of Microsoft leaves behind a legacy which is stunning and vast, and included and was highlighted by his saving of the franchise in Seattle from an imminent move to LA. He designed and partly funded the building of what is now CenturyLink Field. He bought us Mike Holmgren, Sean Alexander, Matt Hasselbeck, the best to ever do it in Walter Jones, played his entire career in Seattle because of, amongst other things, the relationship he had with Mr. Allen. All of those played a part of what happened on 22nd of January in 2006.
Carolina 17. Matthew Kuiper looks down the middle of the field. Touchdown, Seahawks!
Two possessions, 2-3 and outs for the Panthers, who yet to look to number 89, but Eugene, I get the feeling that's about to change.
Drops back, stumbles, does the ball. Now he steps up, throws to the middle of the field. It's intercepted to Duper. He's inside the 30, to the 25 on the far right side of the field. Knocked down at the 20-yard line. Lofa Tupu comes up big when he has to. Seattle has it first and 10 deep in Carolina territory. Smith is in the slot right. DeLoma's going to throw again. Drops back 5. Looks in the middle of the field. Dumps it off. Ball is picked up. Marquand Manuel at the 50. Dumps back to 45 to 40. He's got a convoy. The 25. The 20. Knocked out of bounds at the 17-yard line. The stands are actually shaking right now from the fans, and they have picked off Jake DeLoma for the second time in the first. He pushes ahead. Touchdown, Seahawks! Sean Alexander from 1 yard out over his left guard, the Pro Bowler and old pro Steve Hutchinson.
And the guy that missed.
Pump fake by Matthew. He's throwing to the end zone. He's got D.J. who makes a move. Touchdown, Seahawks! Daryl Jackson from 20 yards out leaps into the stands of the south end zone. Sebeck will take the knee a couple of times, and the party will really start. The flashball.
That's it, Steve.
And the crowd say it all. We're going to Detroit to play in the Super Bowl against the Pittsburgh Steelers.
He then, in late 2009, early 2010, pitched the project and the reins of this team to the most successful coach over the first decade of this millennium. With the brash nature, the chip on the shoulder carried everywhere, and perhaps the greatest defense the league has seen over the past 30 years, all was assembled on Mr. Allen's watch and with his blessing to bring in the parts which made it all up. Here is what a somber Pete Carroll said on his friend and boss last Tuesday.
We've all been deeply moved by the sudden passing of our owner, Paul Allen. We're still in the midst of dealing with all of just the emotions and the concerns and all that come to you immediately at a time like this. And so around here, we're all hanging together and staying really close and just making sure that we're doing all the things that we need to do to carry on and really maintain the effort and the spirit that Paul always stood for, and which was extraordinary achievement, extraordinary idealist, keep pushing always to do great things. And I feel fortunate that we're the ones that get to carry on the messaging in that regard. And we have this extraordinary way to connect with the people in the area, you know, through our play. And sometimes sports just serves perfectly when you need it, and this is a good time for this. This was a great man and an extraordinary guy to work with and to compete with and a good friend and all of that. So we, the families and everybody, our hearts go out to everyone, and we miss we'll miss every aspect of our relationship. But so, with that, we're going to miss a good friend.
Your belief in Paul, what was it at that stage when you were considering whether to leave or not that struck you about Paul and made you want to come to school?
He was able to pass along the spirit that he now we know, I know, of wanting to go for it and kind of no holds barred. And you know, he was going to clear it for us to have a great chance to do great things, and he wanted to, you know, he wanted to win championships, and that's what he was all about, and he wasn't going to let anything get in the way. And he was really clear about that, and the message that came through was really one that I hadn't heard in that fashion with that commitment and that spirit of it, and that's what made it even possible to even be in the conversation about it. And so and Todd Lewicki was really the one that, you know, passed along the messaging at the time and reassured in a way that was, I trusted, you know, and I found trust early in that conversation and relationship that became one that was so well founded, as I learned later on as we got together and really started going about it and battling together and doing the things we needed to do to put the program together.
How familiar
Yeah, well, he's certainly that. I echo that with Mike. This, you couldn't ask for a better guy to support what we're trying to do here. Paul had a great thought about he wanted to put people in charge and give them what they needed and the resource they needed, and then he'd go for it. He wanted you to go for it, and he didn't want you to hold back. He wanted to at all times be pushing ahead, and that's all we could ever hope for, you know. He was not a hands-on owner, but his spirit was on everything that we were doing, and he was. The message was clear how he wanted us to go about our business. That's why John and I were in such concert from the beginning. You couldn't ask for a better format and a better setup, and that's why I wanted to, you know, find my way here. So, I think, you know, Coach Mike was on it. Will
you stay? You regularly had pregame conversations on the field. What were the nature of those like, and what kind of information was he
in? Yeah, he just wanted to know how much we were going to blitz or if we had any trick plays and stuff, basically. By that time, that close to game time, there would always be questions about guys who were hurt or, you know, were healthy and all that kind of stuff. Always want to know about the quarterback and what we were hoping to do and how we're going to defend the other quarterback. So it's pretty basic, fundamental stuff that a fan would want to know going into the game if they could ask the head coach, you know. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough good answers for him. I wish I had better answers for him. But for the most part, we just kind of had fun with it and kind of enjoyed the excitement of the day and what was coming and the challenge and what we were trying to accomplish and all that. Yeah, thanks for the question. Now, I'm going to miss the spirit of his vision. You know, look what he's stood for. Look what he's done. Look at all of the extraordinary, amazing places he's taken us to because he could and because it was there to be challenged. You know, whether it's in space or whether it's under the ocean, whether it's in the farthest reaches of the globe and chasing diseases and freeing animals and saving the elephants. And I mean, all the amazing things that he stood for just being around an amazing individual like that, you know, that had that kind of vision. And it never was about the resources. It never was about the amounts of things. It was about the challenge of discovery and stuff that was so great and it was so much fun to be associated with. I mean, haven't been very fortunate to be around anybody like that, of that nature. And so I feel very fortunate. I'll miss the heck out of him. Well, it's been a life's experience, really. This one, you know, I had this amazing time in down in Southern California, and would never really could imagine that we could match something like that. But we were able to do that here, you know, and come up and connect with the community, represent, you know, a huge area that people cared so much about. You know, this turned out to be a life's experience, you know, for us and my family and all, and we've been able to share in a really, you know, unforgettable ways.
Without Mr. Allen, none of this would be happening. None of what happened over the last week in London would have either. But without question, his legacy, the work he put in, and the moments, his ideals he brought to this team, the area, and the fan base will never be forgotten, will they, Adam?
No, it was so stunning. I mean, it's not often that you look at your phone and kind of your mouth genuinely opens in shock. And this was certainly one of those moments. You just saw kind of the three or four people are tweeting about this story, and it properly took a double take for me. Because as you say, when the tweet came out a few weeks ago that he was, you know, been diagnosed again with the disease, you thought, well, you know, it sounds fairly positive, and by all accounts the way people had been discussing it was fairly positive, and to hear it was just so shocking. And I don't really know what else to add apart from condolences, because it was just such a terrible situation.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times when people like this die so suddenly, it's a case of where he wasn't really appreciated while he was around. It's called like all in memoriams and all that, but that wasn't the case with Paul Allen, was it? Especially in Seattle and in Portland.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of people who have sadly taken the opportunity to grandstand a bit for retweets and likes, but it struck me that when people pass in sports, and certainly people who are incredibly wealthy and involved in ownership, there's always a sentence that starts sort of despite his dealings with, or even though he was often mixed up with this. There's been absolutely none of that with Paul Allen. No. Every rapport has just been completely glowing and effusive and full of praise about what seemed to be just the most terrific human, first and foremost. And then secondarily, you know, a fantastic owner
to the Seahawks that, you know, I say the word Seahawks and not the word Seattle, because, you know, perhaps without Paul Allen, it probably wouldn't have been the Seattle Seahawks. That is how deep his roots in the team ran and how important he was as a man to the franchise. And it's just a terrible loss for everyone involved. And it was pretty heartbreaking seeing how, you know, Pete Carroll is always such a positive and at worst gives nothing away. So to see that sort of raw emotion, it was terrible. And just something that I'm sure the team will mark in a tremendous way going forward, but something that is rightly being mourned by the city and the world of Seahawks fans.
Yeah, and as you said, social media was flooded with former players and employees who came through the 206 under the stewardship of Paul Allen. It wasn't just the likes of Matt Hasselbeck and Walter Jones. Obviously, Mike Holmgren said he was the best owner he ever worked for, but it was people who basically been in Seattle for a cup of coffee the last few months, like Rashad Penny. They've all had dealings. And yet again, it was just nothing but positive and good words coming from those, even if they knew him 20 years or 20 weeks, Adam.
No, I heard Walter speaking on the radio, and he said that he just had this aura of a guy that, you know, when he turned up into the room, there was no fanfare, but he was the guy you immediately go over and shook his hand and asked how he was doing. Nate Burleson was on with Softy last week, and that is a really fantastic and poignant interview.
He said Paul Allen was a billionaire with a trillionaire's heart or something, didn't he?
Yeah, and just the way in which Paul Allen was obviously, you know, treated people on a human level, despite the fact that he was, you know, they were ultimately his employees. It was just lovely to listen to, and it just added some really nice colour and texture to the story of what seems to be a terrific human being.
Yeah, so under Allen, over the 21 years, Paul Allen was the owner of our Seattle Seahawks. The team went from the basement of the league to a powerhouse and a go-to destination for free agents, and obviously draft picks enjoyed coming here too. The team won 9 division titles in those 21 years, made 3 Super Bowl appearances, which was obviously topped off by that wondrous night at MetLife 4 years ago. So from everyone over this side of the pond, every Seahawk fan in the land, and from the Pedestrian Podcast most prominently, thank you very much, Paul Allen. So, yeah, as we said, that gut punch on the news from about the Seahawks owner Paul Allen came just 24 hours after the conclusion of what was one of the more wild, loose, memorable weekends, not just for myself, Adam, but just everyone involved, everyone who made the trip to London. Everyone was at Wembley on Sunday, Green Man on Sunday, the Barrow Boil Week Revolution in Leadenhall. It was quite a few days, wasn't it, Adam?
Indescribable. I mean, we've had a couple of WhatsApp chats where it's just been like, oh, remember that? And remember that? And oh, that was amazing. And oh, do you remember when you did that? And I did that. And it's just been, I don't know, it was such a, obviously I live in London, so it, you know, it was areas that I've recognised, you know, being out in King's Cross and going to Wembley and going out in the city. I'm used to it, but it almost felt like being like in a dream scenario and being removed from life. I mean, I was away from Rosie pretty much every night for about 6 nights. How she let me get away with that, I'll never know. But it was just, yeah, it took a lot of flowers and a heck of a dinner that I made her on Monday evening to make up for it. But it was just fantastic. And I'm still buzzing off it. And actually it's just re-imbued me with a spirit of like, go on, Seattle.
I think I said to you, I said to everyone, like when I got to London on the Wednesday, I was like, this is like the last time I'm going to see Seattle for a couple of years. Let's enjoy it. I'm going to Seattle next year. It's just, as you say, it's just kind of like,
I was looking at flights for the Redskins game in December.
It's kind of like reattached. It's going, like Arizona was, the game was a slog to get through. And then obviously we've had all the stuff the first couple of weeks, all the off-season stuff, off-season moves. It's kind of been, it's just not been much fun, but yeah, that reconnected to everything. Obviously, it was 4 years after the first one, and every trip we've had, especially in our like mini clique we have, it just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Yeah, I have to say that when the Seahawks got announced as the game playing in London, obviously yeah. we're buzzing, but part of the reason for the Seahawks for me means a lot is that it means I get to go to Seattle, see my friends, see my family. And I was almost a bit like, oh, so I guess I'm not going to be able to go this year because they'll be here. And, you know, that'd be cool. And then, you know, the week started off Monday, Tuesday. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, looking forward to seeing my mates and whatever. And then it's Wednesday comes and we're out until 1:30 in the morning with Walter Bloody Jones. And it just kicks off from there. And somehow, it only got better.
I mean, you walked up to me after about an hour in the pub on Trafalgar Square. This is just going to be just really in the actor's studio for the next 10 minutes. So, but you walked up to me, well, this is not uncool. And it, like, that was, as you said, that was like the start of it. I could have gone home Thursday morning and been firing my weekend, spent all night drinking and laughing, and Walter Jones remembered my name from 2 years ago. It was wild. And it, as you said,
and we met, you know, friend of the show Mike Dugar and all of his mates from Washington State, which was great fun. And, you know, I was showing them around London doing a night tour, and it was just insanely good fun. I was just smiling for 6 days.
Yeah, constantly. it was quite something. As Dave Niehaus or Mariners broadcast, you say, it just continued onto Thursday when the Barrel Boy opened up. I mean, to pull back a little bit, me and Adam said, we'll get there for lunchtime, we'll have a few hours, we'll see Walt, and then we'll go out for some food. That was the plan, wasn't it, Adam?
I don't think I ate one thing that whole day.
I had breakfast waffles at about 12:15, and that was it, because we didn't leave till probably gone midnight on Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, I was bouncing around talking to, you know, people that, you know, you'd met in Seattle or new friends, and, you know, welcome into the city. And I kept thinking, I'll get some lunch in a second, but I'll just go and speak to this person and get them to sign the C-Jack. And, you know, I'll just do a quick interview with the head of the Renton Seahawkers that, you know, Anna, that we had on last week with the live podcast, or I'll just laugh at Terry Peppard for a couple of minutes because, you know, that's always good, the Peppard. And then all of a sudden it got to 6:07, and Sean and Claire, our friends from Manchester, arrive, and it just kicked off.
It was Gordon and Ewan, the Patriots fan, who got abused for 5 days and took it fantastically well. And it was so cool because obviously on top of that, we've got Mark and Danny come all the way from Anchorage, from Alaska, which we saw in New York last year, met them 2 years ago in Seattle. You got Paul and Brittany who come from Seattle, although Paul is originally from Edinburgh. It was just, you saw so many familiar faces, but then obviously met so many new people who were just as equally as entrenched with this team and as excited about what was going on all around us, weren't they? And obviously we saw the regular UK Seahawkers at every pull of a beer pump, aren't they, as well? Like James and Rachel, Duncan and Emma. Obviously you've got Mr. Wright, who had the privilege of sitting next to Walter Jones for 3 hours while he signed everything. It's just one hell of a weekend. And also then you put on Facebook the other day asking for people's memories, and for once a podcast related post went viral, Adam.
Yeah, I wish they all got so many likes and comments. It was amazing. And if there's one thing that I've left the weekend thinking, it's that, you know, we can all be away from each other for, you know, 2 years. Some people I've not seen for, or a year. And as soon as everyone's back in the room, it's just one big family. You're straight back into the same jokes. It's you know, the same banter. And, you know, seeing the joy on so many faces, and, you know, the shock of so many American fans that came over, especially to the party at Revolution on Saturday, saying, oh my God, you guys put on such an amazing party. I mean, I did nothing to organize it, but you guys as a collective of the committee, all right. As a collective of the committee, the efforts people went into, and we managed to put on a road game that at least was what the fans get over in the States. And really, that's an incredible effort for a group, you know, that's so small and burgeoning.
Obviously the Barrel Boy was a lot more NFL team led, but as soon as those doors opened on Thursday until the final whistle went on Sunday, it was like, I mean, I've done two road games, you were in New York last year, it was unlike anything else in comparison to that. Salt in Arizona was incredible, especially the Sunday morning. Obviously we went with Carlos in New York last year, which was really, really cool, just because it was basically, as Jana, who has watched the game, has said, that it was just like being home in Seattle walking into that bar in the East Village in New York. It was just as soon as the door opened, obviously the Titans played the Chargers this past weekend. I know someone who's well involved with the UK Titans, and the Titans had the owner, they had Eddie George there, but the whole experience that the Seahawks put on at the Barrel Boy especially was incredible. Jeff Richards and all of his team, all the guys there, obviously you heard Jeff on the podcast last week, deserve nothing but the highest praise. Obviously we do give the Seahawks a little bit of a jip on this podcast from time to time, but they deserve nothing but plaudits for how fan experience centric everything was in comparison to what I've heard has happened with London games in the past, and also this past weekend. It was, as you can tell, we're both still absolutely buzzing, Adam.
Yeah, it was just brilliant. And just, it's the people. The people always make it. And, you know, whether it's chanting stupid Spurs chants, you know, with Nick and Jordan and Abby and them giving me crap about Spurs players and whatever, but we're all in Seahawk gear. And then, you know, met new friend Lucy, who hung out with us for the week, who just came up and said hello and all of a sudden spent the whole week with us. You got Jana and Krista, friends from New York and Seattle. It's just one massive community. And it was just such a joy. And I was gutted on Monday morning when it was all over, because it just felt like I'd blinked and it was all gone.
Everything. Absolutely everything. It was all just, ridiculous. Also, a lot of people.
I mean, it was even weird seeing Steve Rabel with a microphone screaming touchdown Seahawks in a bar in London. That's unheard of.
Absolutely ridiculous. Dave Wyman was just standing upstairs. We had ESPN, Jessamyn McIntyre from ESPN messaging us asking to get in. It was just the most surreal experience. And there's things like my new profile picture on Facebook is one of my favourite pictures, but also there's a picture with Jess, Mike Dugar and all his cronies in the Helsinki Hope hoodies. It's two of my favourite photos I've ever been a part of, even though I'm a sweaty mess in the group one. It is, just there's so many things. That's not going to be topped. And it's just, it was just ridiculous.
So, I mean, I asked for, a few people's memories, and I think Tom Cunningham sums it up well when he says, one outstanding memory, apart from the game itself, was getting a picture with yourself and Stuart up at the Green Man, slightly starstruck. I have to say, slightly starstruck is the main surprise. It should be starstruck, really. I mean, two absolute celebs walking around, but that was great. And then Gordon Wright talking about how much money he spent on vodka, which I daren't ask, although I know because I did the same thing. You've got Connor Tyrell saying resounding memory, random high fives in London streets more than 48 hours before the kickoff. Gordon's put up a fantastic picture of the 3 and the 12 and the Sea Jack from Revolution. Dan Osborne's got a cracking point of the volume of the boos when the Raiders came out was a real statement. It was honestly like being at the Century League when that happens.
As you can hear at the start of this podcast, Adam's voice was, my voice is still like it. It wrote me off more. It's a lot of this is due to Jada jabbing me and Martin in the ribs when we didn't join in every down in the second half, and the game is one in hand. But my voice has never been that ruined on a Monday morning in Seattle.
Yeah, and thanks to people like Lestoff and Andy England and Martin Opry, who have all just talking about just what great atmosphere it was in general. And, El Presidente, Sean, a few nice recaps from him. Do go and have a look at that thread on the UK group, because there's some fantastic pictures, and it's a really good way to add some colour and texture to the week. Putting it through lots of other fans' eyes. Steve Sullivan sums it up really well. The friendliness of everyone I encountered over the weekend was incredible. For the team to pull off such a fantastic party at a class venue on Saturday was unreal. I felt a real connection with complete strangers, and that is the power of Hawks fans. And I don't think you can't say that better.
When we spoke Mike Dugar last week for this podcast, it was a really fun chat. And I said to you after we spoke to him, it's like he's been back in America for 2 days, 3 days, and he's still buzzing. I wish that had failed recording. You could just hear how excited and how much he enjoyed his 4 or 5 days. A lot of that obviously had them to do with me and you.
Well, yeah, that's true. Let's be honest. But He was buzzing, and at some point we'll get him back on to recap some of his London thoughts, because they were really great, and introducing some of the Hilinski Hope stuff and seeing the warmth on their faces at such a fantastic cause that raised a tremendous amount of money that you should take so much credit for was just brilliant.
It was obviously a lot of people to thank before we move on and invite Rob on to this week's podcast. Obviously, with the Saturday night, a massive, massive nod and a round of applause to Mel and Sean, particularly Mel, who booked the venue and dealt with all the tickets and everything. I knew how much the room cost and wasn't sure until I walked in and went, oh yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. It was an incredible venue, perfect spot. Walking outside about 10 to 7 and seeing the line of the queue, it was like, it was just the queues outside that place was just incredible for what was pretty much just a meet-up. What we thought with a few people, I mean, 600 people later, we had all the Seahawks. Dignitary of Steve Rabel was just the best. Dave Wyman was there, obviously the guys from ESPN were there as well. Blitz was there as well, schmoozing around the room. It was just unreal. So massive thanks to Sean, Mal, and everyone, Terry, Cedric, all the rest of the guys on the committee, but Mal most probably because she's the one who dealt with all the tickets side of that most. And then obviously, as I said, the Seahawks themselves, Jeff Richards, massively. I mean, how much fun was that chat, Adam?
Brilliant fun. The questions were great. One day, maybe you guys get to hear
somewhere
them.
In the deep dives of this laptop, those questions will be heard one day. It was just, and then obviously people like Mike Dugar was brilliant. Obviously, all the story he wrote on The Athletic, if you haven't read it, if you haven't subscribed, please go subscribe. It is a great site, great service, and it is a pretty cool article. Now, John Boyle, we spoke to on myself, Gordon, Andrew Robinson, a few others spoke to on Saturday morning. We really do appreciate that. Mike Verrall as well from the Seattle Times. Gary Horcher on one of the Seattle networks. All of the coverage. Aaron Levine spent an hour with Terry Peppard. I wish I had the opportunity to ask him what that was like. The pep up was brilliant on it, so massive, massive thanks to that. And obviously, for myself, a massive, massive thank you to everyone who bought a hoodie, a t-shirt, a wristband, or even signed the Washington State Cougar flag, which was just positioned just in front of myself and Adam were set up. So big thanks to you as well, Adam, for helping out. But final numbers are not confirmed because we still have a bit of stock left, which will be going up on the site. And posted that in over the coming days and weeks. But yeah, massively appreciate. And obviously everyone digging deep for the auction, which had, it started off with about 4 items, ended up with about 24 on that table. A massive thanks also, as I said, to yourself, Adam, for helping, Alan Kennedy for helping, Tom Harris and Martin Offery for helping with the auction and t-shirts, Gordon Wright for trying to sort it, even though it was quite a mess by that point in night, but really is appreciating. Obviously, Adam, one more thing, a massive thanks to Rosie for the big chill call as well on this Friday night.
She did pick a very good club. We managed to get Walter Jones in on his tracksuit bottoms, which again is not a sentence I thought I'd ever have to say. But our friend Jana running around a club with a picture of Walter Jones on Google saying, this guy's outside, where's the manager, you need to let him in, it somehow worked. And again, just another ridiculous story from
And if you're ever in London and you want to be fed well, make sure you look up Adam D. Nathan on Twitter, because he will certainly feed you well, especially on the Wednesday night with what was basically the entire cast of Babe, I think we had, didn't we?
Babe 1, 2, and 3.
Just amazing weekend. Massive thanks to everyone who was involved, everyone I mentioned. If I've ever mentioned you, just think that it's an honorary nod in your direction. Let's hope they do it again. And if nothing else, if you don't want to go to Seattle after those 4 or 5 days in London, then you just need to go, because that was fun, but Seattle is that on steroids to a certain extent, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something that has to be done. If you can get over there at any stage, it's brilliant. And I'm sure the group will be inundated with people desperate to get out there and see the Emerald City.
Yeah, and obviously the buzz is clearly aflame after London as well, because obviously there already was the Glasgow meet, which is on the 16th of December. Nottingham, Kieran Byrne, was Newark, more than Nottingham, Nottinghamshire. There is a meet for the Rams game on the 11th of November in a pub in Newark. And then obviously myself and James have organised the Super Bowl party, which is on February 3rd at O'Neill's on Broad Street. And there could be something quite cool coming off the back of that if all goes well. Yeah, all the details are on the Facebook, on Twitter. But now it's time to introduce and talk about the game and talk about what's coming this week. Weekend up in Detroit. We're going to welcome on someone who had a different experience, but probably an equally cool experience, covering the team a lot more intently than we were over that weekend. It's time to welcome on Rob Staton to the pod. So we're going to do that now.
Russell Wilson, end zone throw, touchdown, and the Seahawks strike first. Jerron Brown on 3rd and 5 from the Raider 30. Carr under pressure, the ball is out, fumble recovered for a moment, and the Seahawks have come up with it. Jaron Reed, ball's bobbled, but Wilson has it for the end zone. Wide open, catch made. David Moore has a Seahawk tumbling touchdown. It's on 3rd and 11, avoids the rush for a moment, but gets sacked way back at the 33-yard line. This is about. It's up there. It's out there. And he worked it in there. Carried 9 times for just 14 yards. And Laura, they're down to their third string guard. And now another sack. Fourth sack of the game of Carr. 3rd and 16. Here comes another one. Ball comes out. And the Seahawks have it. He turned over another one. Jacob Martin comes up with the fumbled football. Kowski from 26 yards away. He's already hit one today. And he delivers. Russell Wilson on the run for the end zone. Touchdown, Seahawks. Jerron Brown leaping. Make that Tyler Lockett leaping on the toss.
So, yeah, so that's mine and Adam's London experiences. Now it's time to call on one of our stable of guests. Rob Staton was one of the media members who packed into the Grove over Seahawks in London week and weekend. He joins us again on the Pedestrian Podcast. How are we, Rob?
Really good, fellas, yeah. Had a great time in London and a good result to end a decent few days.
Yeah, and but Oakland quickly were a quite tragic team there, weren't they? A lot worse than I think I realised they were.
Yeah, tragic's a good word. I think going into the game, there was a feeling, just from the press point of view, I know people who were at the Seahawks press conferences and the practices, and there was people at the Oakland practices. And what the Seahawks did is they got the flight over on the Thursday, did a practice as soon as they got off the plane, and were just right into it and trying to adjust to the time difference and getting out on the field and making sure that any weariness was run off, really. Oakland turned up on Friday night, and I imagine, because they stayed in the Hilton across the road from Wembley, whereas the Seahawks are in a proper facility where the England national team stay before they play at Wembley. Oakland were in the Hilton. It's kind of like they went for a weekend away and probably just did a walkthrough in the hotel before the game. And it just show. And the word from the Oakland, from people who were at the Oakland media events, was that it was a shambles. Marshawn Lynch was doing opening a store in Selfridges, Beast Mode store, pop-up store in Selfridges at 4:30 the day before the game. There was another Oakland player, I think it was in the Nike shop or something, at 3 o'clock the day before the game. And the writing was on the wall. It seemed quite early that this was going to be quite a one-sided game.
Yeah. So how was your London experience? Was it what you expected, or?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was better than I expected, actually. I mean, I went there and had a chance to get to the press events. It was great to be able to ask a question of Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner and the Griffin brothers and one or two others. That was really fun. Really enjoyed that. One of the big highlights for me was meeting Dave Wyman, who was pretty hilarious, and telling him some of the English swear words, which he then proceeded to use on the radio, which was even better to hear those words popping up on the radio, because you could never say them on the BBC. So it was great to hear them on the American radio. And then the game. And look, I've flown to Seattle and watched Seattle lose in quite horrendous fashion 3 times. So it was nice to not have to travel all those thousands of miles and actually see a comprehensive win. That's the first time I've seen the Seahawks win a comfortable victory. So to sort of end with that one very one-sided game, I don't think we learned too much from about Seattle in that game. I think we learned more about the Raiders, but it was still good to see a good comprehensive Seahawks win in London.
Yes. What do you reckon that the team made of kind of the whole situation? Because before the week started, I said to Stu that Pete Carroll seemed a little bit down about the whole thing and not that he was that looking forward to it. And it was a bit disappointing to hear some of it. But by the time we got, you know, they got there, and Stuart and I know a few guys in the Seattle media, and they seemed to have an absolute blast and were saying that the players seemed to really enjoy it. Obviously, they're going to pay lip service and say, oh, it was fantastic. What a great trip. And thanks to all the fans. But it did seem from the post stuff that they probably enjoyed the whole thing slightly more than they figured they would on Monday morning.
Yeah, I think everybody associated with Seattle really kind of enjoyed the trip. I got the same vibe from the journalists that they really had a great time being in the locker room after the game. It seemed like the players had a very enjoyable experience, and I interviewed a couple of the offensive linemen, and you know, there was definitely no quibbles about playing in London from them. Pete Carroll was sort of gushing in his praise of the whole thing and said that he would happily go back to London again in the future. I don't think it'll happen anytime soon for the Seahawks, but I think they all saw it as a huge positive thing. And that's not entirely surprising. The preparation was really good. The way that they went out there and stayed at the Grove was a really good plan. And if you get the planning right, then generally I think it will be a positive trip. It helps that they had such an easy win, or a comprehensive win. Carroll, I'm sure, will have sort of been feeling that, you know, that what went wrong in that whole weekend, absolutely nothing. So off the back of it, everybody's very positive. Now, if they came back to London again in 5 years' time, let's say, and they didn't adjust well to the time difference and they were on the receiving end of a beating, then they'd probably feel a little bit differently about it. And it was interesting today when Carroll was asked in his press conference, do you think there'll be a team in London in the future? He was pretty clear in saying he doesn't think that should happen, and he gave a list of reasons why. So I think that they probably still acknowledge there are some issues in terms of that you have to combat when you do travel over to London. But I think this particular experience was a very good one for the Seahawks, and I'm glad about that. You know, it did kind of feel like they were staying, the team and the press and everybody were staying in our own spare room, really, coming over to England. You kind of want them to have a nice time, don't you? You don't want them to have a bad impression of the place that, you know, we all call home. And it seems that everybody had a very good impression of England and of London. And it was great that they won the game and move on.
Yeah. So one of the guys you interviewed was DJ Fluker. Is he as big a human up close as he is on TV?
So that was one of the fascinating things, actually, was being able to watch practice. And admittedly, I'm not the smallest bloke. I mean, I'm 6'3.5". So when I'm stood next to some of the NFL players, they don't. And when I was stood next to Dwayne Brown, my impression was that I was expecting him to be bigger, which is, when you look at him in a picture, you'd think, how on earth could you have that impression? But I think that's because he does look so big. When I was actually stood next to him, I kind of thought, well, I expected him to be bigger than he was. But then there was Brandon Marshall. Standing near Brandon Marshall, it was almost like being stood next to something from one of the Terminator films. It's just incredible, huge human being. And then getting into the locker room afterwards and being out and stack, because all the offensive linemen were sort of together, the five starters. And then you've got a Fedi there, and then sat next to DJ Fluker, and then Justin Britt was stood up and I spoke to him as well, and then Sweezy and Dwayne Brown. And it was a sort of standing next to the collection of them together made you realise you would never want to take one of those on in any kind of sporting contest. So, yeah, Fluker in particular was sat down. What an incredible personality. His energy was great. Even in just a short 2 or 3 minute interview that I did, he was sort of yelling out with passion. And you can see why the team have really taken to him and why he's become such a big part of what has been a turnaround in the offensive fortunes in the last few games.
I was just going to say, I mean, accountability was a big word used in the off-season by the coaches, and you know, that Solari was going to hold Wilson more accountable. But Fluker seemed like the kind of guy that is, you know, if someone messes up an assignment on the offensive line, he's not going to pull any punches. And for me, he's come into like a real leadership role in the team in only such a short space of time, which has been really good to see.
He's been a huge positive. And it's one of the reasons why when we did the press conferences, I wanted to ask Carroll specifically whether or not he saw re-sign, because there's all obviously there's a lot of talk about Frank Clark, as you can imagine, and get him signed up. And if KJ Wright comes back and plays well, there'll be all that talk as well. I think Bobby Wagner was asked about that this week, about his free agency that's pending. But I wanted to ask about Fluker and Sweezy, because to me they seem that, look, what is the big difference? The offensive line, I don't think it was to blame for a lot of the sacks in the first two games. I think we talked about that last time we were discussing this. But look at those two games, and then look at the last few years, and then look at the difference now. And the offensive line actually looks like it could be one of the best in the NFL. And to go from where it was the last couple of years to being where it is now, where they're running they're almost running the ball as well as Dallas did a couple of years ago when Zeke was a rookie. And when you were playing that Dallas team, and I think they won 13 games, it was how on earth do you stop this? The offensive line is just so good that they're pushing people back 2 or 3 yards every time, and it's giving the running backs a chance to be productive. And you kind of see that with the Seahawks at the moment. And I think so much of that is down to, like I say, the accountability and the leadership that people like Fluker and Sweezy are providing, the guidance that someone like Jermaine Fetty's getting. I listened to an interview that Fluker did with Danny David Moore on 710 ESPN this week, and he was talking about, you know, the kind of things he says to Jermaine Fetty, and does hold him accountable and does want him to do the right things here. This is how you do this. Use your size to your advantage. You are this. They're not going to get you around this. The only way that they're going to beat you is this way. So this is what you need to do to combat it. And just that advice, and you can see it in Fetty, who nobody talks about Fetty anymore. And for like the last 2 years, everybody's been talking about what a bust he is. Nobody really talks about him anymore. And that's all you can ask for from your right tackle. And that's because of Fluker and that common influence. And the only thing is, you've got to keep your fingers crossed that he stays healthy, because he's had injury issues everywhere he's been. New York last year, San Diego. That's why I left San Diego, having been in the first rounder there. Let's just hope that he and J.R. Sweezy and the rest of them can stay healthy, because at the moment, they're probably, along with the quarterback, the and perhaps Frank Clark as well, the things that are the most potent in this Seahawks roster at the moment.
Stu, you there?
Yeah, sorry, I had a massive coughing fit during that. So obviously you've worked for BBC, been up close to the clubs over here. Was there anything that stood out in difference from how they deal with the media, and how like we've talked about before, with access that the American press get compared to what our guys over here get? Was there anything else, any of that stood out while you were over at the Grove?
Well, if I went over to America and watched the Premier League teams and they go over there, I've no idea how they do things. But it was nice to... So what you would generally do is you would turn up, you would go in. There was some very nice coffee and biscuits and stuff to eat if you wanted to, which is always nice. And then they sort of take you around to where the practice field is. And you don't get much time to watch. I mean, when you say, here's the practice access, it's not like you get to sit there and watch them do a series of drills and they put on a performance for you and you feel like you've watched something beneficial. You really just go out there and watch the warm-ups. And then when the start of practice is just about to kick off, you may see one or two drills. But then they all say, right, that's it, it's over. And by day two, they were saying, everybody back to the potting shed. So everyone would go back to the greenhouse and wait for the press conference to begin after practice. So then you'd have like an hour's wait. And then, yeah, they put the people up, as I suppose they would do if it was a Premier League team as well. I think the big difference is after the game, when everybody just piles into the locker room. You know, everybody is just there. There are some real sights there. I mean, when I interviewed DJ Fluker, he was literally only wearing a towel. I mean, that's...
Are you sure it wasn't a tent if it was covering it?
It may. Yeah. It was the thing they put over the grass when it took it dry. they borrowed it. So anything goes there, and you really just go up and ask anybody who you want. You know, you go up to people and say, can I interview you for whatever? And you'll either get a yes or a no. And they don't have to speak, but most of them will accommodate you. I think that was the other thing that I noticed. I mean, having interviewed many, many English footballers, and some of them aren't like this, but a lot of them are, they kind of always feel like they're doing you a favour. You know, that they're kind of dragged out by some poor press officer who's got to go and ask will you do the press today? And the response that they get is, oh, God, do I have to? And stuff like this. And they go out and they've got no energy for it. And they don't think anything about it. They don't see the benefit of talking to the press. They don't understand the opportunity it is essentially to communicate with the fans and get on their side as well. Whereas the difference here is I went up to DJ Fluker and kind of, can do a couple minutes. Yep, no problem. Did it. He said thank you to me afterwards. And then when I speak to Justin Britt and interview him, he said thank you. And he almost appreciate the fact that you want to speak to them and you want to talk to them. And these are guys who are multimillionaires. You know, they're set up for life in a way that a lot of English footballers aren't. And that was the noticeable difference. I think just the courtesy and the respect that is shown to the media, which is probably just something that's ingrained within American sport that perhaps we could learn a thing or two about over here.
It's a name drop of the year, but we ended up spending the majority of the week with Walter Jones, which does sound ridiculous even now, still saying it. And, you know, by the time Friday, Saturday came around, I guess the starstruck nature was gone. But when you're out until 3:30 in the morning, I think that'll quickly go away. But, I mean, you obviously write a fantastic blog and a journalist by trade, but presumably you started off writing about the Seahawks because you're a fan. And so was there ever a period at the start where you got, you know, the tiniest bit starstruck of, you know, these are the guys that are followed as my team, and now I'm here with them?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, yeah. I mean, I write the blog. Essentially, I'm just a fan who writes a blog about the draft, and the draft has kind of, the blog's kind of changed from, you know, initially just being something like, let's just tally all the mock drafts and see what people are saying and the odd opinion on a player or two, to, you know, something that talks about the Seahawks, the way that they're playing and the players and the coach. It's become like an overall Seahawks blog that does like to focus on the draft at draft time. But I'm just a fan, really, at the end of the day, who, like everybody else, who blogs a little bit. And, you know, I was privileged to be able to attend those press conferences and, you know, being able to ask Pete Carroll a question. You know, I know that we could sit here and we could quibble about decisions that Pete Carroll has made as the Seahawks head coach, but this is still the head coach that has brought the first Super Bowl to this team. It's the head coach that it created this fantastic journey that they've been on, and all of the fantastic players that have played in the last 8 years with this team. So you've got to have a lot of, whatever you feel about the team currently or have felt it since that second Super Bowl, you've got to have a tremendous amount of respect for the guys. So to be able to sit there, witness one of his press conferences, just be sort of sat in his presence, really, and then be able to sort of just ask him a question, to have him make fun of my English accent in a very light-hearted way. Was great fun when I mentioned the name Sweezy and Fluker, and he found it hilarious that I'd said those names in a very English way. was a highlight, and just, yeah, it was great. And it was the same when Russell Wilson came out, the same when it was going in the locker room, and I'll admit that there was a little bit of anxiety. Do I really want to do this? You know, would I rather just be naive and not know what these people are like and not be given the opportunity to think less of them or see anything negative or be told something negative or to get any kind of negative reaction? That was a tempting thought throughout this whole period. But I'm glad that I didn't sort of let that win out, really, and that I did go and jump two-footed into this and experience it, because I can, you know, if anybody's wondering, what is this group like? And actually, you know, they seem quite fun and it seems like quite a cool team to go and follow. Well, that was exactly the experience I had sort of firsthand, being somewhat around them during this week in London. Nothing but positive feelings about it, and came away afterwards thinking, this is, you know, one of the best things I've done. You know, having followed the Seahawks for a long time, it's a weekend, that's for, so from Thursday to Monday when I was in London, mm-hmm. that I'll carry with me forever. It was a great experience.
That's awesome.
Awesome. So it's like reinforced your fandom.
Yeah, without doubt.
So we've touched on Fluker, touched on a bit of the airline. Obviously, a lot's been made with what the opposing airline did or didn't do at Wembley. Do you think there's been such a seismic shift from going from Slyrie Cable, or is it just that the fact that he's actually bothering to coach these players now?
it's emphatic, the difference, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I always kind of felt like, as you know, we've talked many times on the podcast, I always felt a little bit like Cable and Bevel were an easy target. But I'm happy to sort of concede now that we're here weeks into an NFL season that it does seem like maybe the Seahawks clung on far too long with Tom Cable. And we can see that now. You know, Solari's not somebody who had great success in New York recently, but did have tremendous success in San Francisco. And I don't know, because I don't want to sort of rehash the whole Cable thing. I suppose if Tom Cable was with us right now, which would be interesting, he may well argue that he had an offensive line in the Super Bowl, which was a veteran offensive line. It included a top 10 pick at left tackle. It included another first round pick playing left guard, Max Unger, who was a second round pick, who obviously they were all very fond of. And over time, the Seahawks just broke up that offensive line to save money to pay the Wilsons, the Shermans, the Chancellors, the Thomases, everybody else, the Wagners, the KJ Wrights, everybody who got paid, the Jimmy Grahams eventually. And they had to make a saving somewhere. So Russell Okung, off he goes. They trade Max Unger as part of that Jimmy Graham deal. James Carpenter Guzman has a very decent career in New York with the Jets. Sweezy went off to Tampa Bay. And Giacomini left the team as well. So everybody's gone. And they replaced him, essentially said and look, Tom Cable had some input into this. It's not that Tom Cable didn't have any say. He probably had quite a significant say in the players they brought in. But at the same time, Drew Nowak at centre. we're going to ask you to, you know, who was the, I can't remember the guy's name. Was it Bradley Sowell? Who they had at left tackle on you?
He got Mabushi, he got Sakoli, who they converted after Sweezy.
I mean, it was a tough challenge for any offensive line coach. But that's not to say that, look, last year they had Dwayne Brown, they'd spent the first round pick on Afedi. They had spent the second pick on Posick. That needed to be a better offensive line. The running game completely collapsed. So Cable has to act. I just think that is important to mention, that the line did change a lot from Super Bowl to when eventually Cable left. But now Solari's doing a great job. I think personnel really fits the style that they want to do. They've said for 2-3 years, we want to fix the running game. We want to commit to the run. Well, now they seem to have an offensive line which is going to enable them to do that. Love the way that they're playing. And yeah, I think a huge round of applause has to go to Solari and Schottenheimer. And you do have to wonder, where would the Seahawks team have been if maybe they'd acknowledged this need to do things differently with the offensive line and perhaps with the coaching staff as well a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
In terms of the team in general, I am admittedly an incredibly nervous sports fan, and my nerves manifest itself into basically making me a miserable bastard with my sport, with all the sports teams that I support. And I have to say, the first 5 weeks of the season, it almost felt a bit like a chore watching. I wasn't that looking forward to it, but I needed that game, and I feel, you know, fully kind of re-energized as a fan, which is probably not a great sort of mindset. But I feel like I needed a win like that to show that, you know, I feel like we're back. And, you know, my initial thoughts of 6-10, hopefully, seemingly prove misguided. You're generally more positive anyway, Rob, but I think even you after Arizona were starting to wonder, you know, what are we watching here? What are your general views on it now? Where can this go?
I still think the Seahawks are a 7-9 win team. Mm-hmm. I think I've said that after the Arizona game or whenever it was the last time we had a podcast and felt very negative. It may have been after the Chicago game, negatively about it. I still think that this is a team that is facing a really it's a reset year, and look, it's great that they beat Oakland, great that they were very competitive against the Rams. They were still pretty awful against Arizona, and Dallas have proven to be quite the average team. So this is the big test now, and I hope I'm wrong. I hope that they're a 10-11 win team, and we'll find that out over the next few weeks. I think if they can win 2 of the next 5, they'll be well set to maybe to finish with a bit of a flourish here, because the last 5 games, I think, are pretty... they're not in that intimidating. The Chiefs game, I think, is the penultimate game, but by that point, are they already going to have clinched the number one seed in the AFC? It's in Seattle. It could be, if Seattle's got a bit of momentum going there, it could be quite an interest. It could be a bit of a game like the Rams game, but they might actually win that one. So I do think there's a chance if they can win 2 of the next 5. And that doesn't sound like an awful lot, does it? Just win 2 from the next 5. But when you look at the teams that they're playing, I think we'll learn a lot about them over the next 5 games. Yeah. I still think, and I agree with you completely, I think we all needed the Rams before. I think not getting absolutely hammered by the Rams and then absolutely hammering the Raiders was something we all needed. I found all of last season a massive chore.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time. I mean, because even in the 2009, in 2008, it was kind of like, okay, this is the end of this era. A new one's going to start. So you could kind of just put it to one side. 2009 with Moore was very frustrating. But I don't know. I always had this inner feeling that something big was going to happen if it continued, and it did. And they brought in Pete Carroll. And then as they've built things up, it's always been kind of exciting. It's been a journey. And then last year, to me, just felt like, oh, I mean, even the wins were exhausting. Yeah. There was just, it wasn't fun. There was nothing fun about a Seahawks team that has been just the definition of fun for years up until that point.
It's always been worth staying up till midnight, if that makes sense.
It has.
And last year it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. And it was for the first time they were winning games. And when there was, if it was like a winning, if they won it late, I wasn't jumping out of my seat, you know, to celebrate a touchdown if I was watching on the TV. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, oh, great, okay, they've won. And that was the sort of, and if they lost, it was like, oh, God, they've lost. So you want to have that amount. And that Oakland game was good. It felt good to see a team that was physically punishing an opponent and not playing down to their level, but actually just taking it away from them. But I still, look, I'm not that confident about the game coming up against Detroit. Mm-hmm. And then if you lose that, I think you have to, you're looking at then, okay, you've got to do your business at home. You've then maybe got to win one of these road games, like the Carolina game maybe, which is, again, these are winnable games, Detroit and Carolina, but they're also losable games. So I do think we'll learn a lot about this team. I still think they're a team with a significant lack of depth in key positions. Mm-hmm. If they have any more key injuries, and they've already lost quite a few, they could be in some bother. I think it's great the way that they're running the ball. I hope they can maintain that, but that is going to rest upon the health of that offensive line and staying on track with it. And as we've seen too often, I'm afraid to say, with this team, it doesn't take them much to knock them away from running the ball. And I just anticipate a game where we just see them unnecessarily move away from it and not stick to what they've been doing the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, but this whole team and how they look last few games, it is kind of like 2011, 2012, where we've seen people like David Moore, Trey Flowers, and Bakivius Mingo. People, it's kind of what we saw from like Baldwin, Sherman, and that 2012 draft class, isn't it? A little bit. It's like they're starting to settle in, and the only thing is upside with those guys, and it's kind of what we saw 5-6 years ago, isn't it?
I thought that, but then during this bye, I ended up watching the, because I kind of felt that connection, you know, to 2011. And I went back and watched the Rain City Redemption episode from 2011 to try and just to see if that was, I was right to feel that way. And as I was watching it, I kind of thought, no, it's not the same. It's not, and I hate to say it, I just don't think it is. Because I was watching the second, you know, you're watching Sherman and Brandon Browner, and you're seeing Cam absolutely destroying people, and there's Earl there, you know, peak Earl, just really, not, even before his peak, you know, sort of turning into that. And you've got young KJ, and then the one thing that was holding back that Seahawks team was the quarterback situation. You've got Tavares Jackson, did a decent job that season, but it was no Russell Wilson, was he? So the one thing they needed was the quarterback to sort of take them over the edge. And this team is very different. So now you've got the quarterback, you've got a running game. It's not Marshawn Lynch, but it's a running game that's working. But then you look at the defensive backs, and I still just think there's talent there. They're being very well coached, they're producing, but it's not the same as that blossoming LOB that just intimidated the heck out of teams. And it's that did really feel like a young team that was growing and building just needed a quarterback. Now it kind of feels like a team that has the quarterback and therefore will be competitive, but is weak in some areas. And in particular, like, imagine if they lose a cornerback in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, who's playing cornerback? You know, Nico Thorpe's going to be starting, and maybe that's fine, but I don't know. And if they lose a safety, you know, can you imagine if it was Tedrick and Delano Hill at safety, or Shalom Luani, you know, you then you start to think, oh, that's a concern. And KJ's been injured, you know, if Bobby plays a million snaps, what if Michael Kendricks doesn't come back? Does that become an issue? And yeah, you know what, Frank Clark looked like Lawrence Taylor against Oakland, but Oakland's line's obviously horrendous and young, and there have been other games this year where they've not laid a finger on the quarterback, the Rams game being an example of that. And I really worry about that pass rush, that it may feast on an Oakland Raiders line with Tom Cable and his two rookie tackles. But How are they going to do against Detroit this weekend? How are they going to do against the Chargers? How are they going to do against the Packers? How are they going to do against the Chiefs? You know, that's the acid test, really.
Yeah.
Carroll made an interesting comment on Monday in his press conference saying about the Denver game and the Chicago game that I can't really describe how he said it, that almost like he misassessed what he meant, what he wanted to do with the running game. It was strange.
He said that they realized what was wrong, but they didn't change it, and that was on him.
I mean, he does, you know, he is a wordsmith in kind of the worst way possible. The way in which he uses language can be incredibly frustrating at times. But presumably, the way this team are going to win, if they're going to win, is by running. I mean, it's not necessarily my favorite thing to watch, but I think it's pretty undeniable that's the way how we're going to go this year, isn't it? And just let Wilson be efficient, if not explosive.
Yeah, I mean, even the recollection of what you just said there about what Carroll said recently and remembering those two games, I find it massively frustrating.
Yeah.
because they spent all off-season saying we're going to be a running team, and they draft a running back in the first round, and they change all the offensive coaches, and everything's geared towards fixing the run. And then the first two games are just a continuation of everything they've done wrong for the last couple of years. And you're thinking, well, what was that all about? You know, what was that whole off-season message about? And then, you know, I respect the hell out of Pete Carroll, but for him to say, I got that wrong and we didn't do what we should have done, I kind of think, well, that you shouldn't have made that mistake, because you were so clear in what you wanted to do. There was no, we needed to find out who we were. You stated clearly who you wanted to be and then didn't do it. And that's what is irritating a little bit, because I think now that we look back on those two games, Chicago's probably a little bit better than we all expected. They have acquired Khalil Mack after all, but they're still a beatable team, even at Soldier Field. Mm-hmm. And Denver, clearly a beatable team. I know there's all this thing about week one in Denver, they've become a very tough opponent to beat. I think they started 2-0, but they're a beatable opponent there. And if the Seahawks had just split those games, and at 4-2, I know it's only one game difference. It feels so much more different right now.
Yeah.
This whole the whole feeling in this bye. If only lost the Bears on the road and the Rams in a narrow, brave performance at home at CenturyLink Field. Just think how positive we'd be feeling about this team. So to fudge it so emphatically in those two games, I think is and look, this has been a theme, hasn't it? The Seahawks have always started with some, you know, very strange stuff going on offense every single season, pretty much, under Carroll. And this was, at least the consistent in that regard, but it doesn't make it any less frustrating. It feels like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah. So obviously the Oakland game is in the rear view. The Seahawks stand at 3-3 after the absolute demolition. I think, like you said earlier, Rob, about how comfortable it was. It was more comfortable than New York a year ago, wasn't it, Adam? I mean, that was second half was comfortable, but the first half was agonizing.
I've never into a Seahawks game that's that comfortable, actually. It was most enjoyable.
Yeah. So, obviously, this week the team do return back on the road yet again. They head to Detroit to face the team that are also 3-3 with two pretty impressive home wins under their bat on 2018. Confidence not that high then, Rob, this Sunday?
It's not that I'm lacking confidence. I think I'm sort of in a wait and see mode with them, really. I think it was great. Oakland was great. I can feel the positivity. I like the identity that they've established. I also think Carroll's been a little bit guarded. When you listen to his press conferences, he's certainly not getting carried away. I think he knows that this is a really difficult stretch of games that they've got coming up, and they've got to prove that they're still a team that can be competing for the playoffs. And when you look at sort of the Panthers roster and you look at the Bears as well, and you could say, well, okay, they've got holes like the Seahawks have, and they've maybe got a lack of depth in certain areas. There's nothing to stop the Seahawks competing with these teams, but I think you do need to see them show it. They've won three games. One is against an awful Oakland team who may end up picking first overall. One was against an awful Arizona team who may end up picking first overall. who was the other one?
Dallas,
who... there's just something about the Cowboys. They just look destined for 8-8, and that game being in Seattle, and it being Seattle's first home game of the season, and it being the game when they actually realised they want to run the ball, I think really played into their favour. So we need to see them beat a decent team. And if they can go and beat Detroit this weekend, then I'll be well on board with thinking playoffs are a possibility. But I just got this feeling that maybe Detroit will throw a few punches, Seattle will throw a few punches, it'll be a close game, and maybe the fact that Detroit are at home may just edge it. But we'll see. And that's not me sort of being doom and gloom about it. I'm just trying to be honest about the situation, and I still think this is a Seahawks. I mean, they are 3-3 after all. I still think 8-8, 9-7, you know, if they have a few injuries, 7-9, I still think that's the safe prediction. It's probably not an exciting prediction. You know, more excited if I said they're going to win 11 games or six. But, you know, I think 7-9 is the safe prediction, and I'm going to go with that until I think they prove that they can do more than that. But I really hope they do. I mean, that doesn't mean that on Sunday I'll be sat here hoping to be proven right. I want to be proven completely wrong. I hope they win 40-0.
Yeah. So, Adam, on Sunday, though, the Detroit Lions, LeGarrette Blount and the impressive-looking rookie, Kerryon Johnson, it's not hard to be, but it's a completely different kettle of fish on offense this week, isn't it, in Detroit?
Yeah, I think Rob made a really good point that we mentioned when he said that, you know, Oakland was the first time we didn't play up or down to the level of our opponent. We just played our game and just, you know, beat the piss out of them, really. And I think Detroit is another game where, you know, they've got a quarterback who's annoying to bring down, and he makes weird throws out of the back of his hand and the side of his hand and all over the place. And they have got some decent playmakers. It is going to be tough because they are going to be much more physical, and it'll be interesting and quite exciting to see how the defense can stand up to that, and how the offense can take on a more functional defense than Oakland. But I think all off-season I was worried that in games like this, often, you know, 8-8 becomes 7-9 or 9-7, basically due to the star power and someone making a big play. And it was great to see Baldwin come back and make some big plays, because you need him to make a few big grabs a game.
Yeah.
And having KJ right back could be crucial if he can make it, because he's the kind of guy that is able to make a big play. And I think it's going to be defined this game by three or four plays, you know. Is a tip going to lead to an interception versus the ball hitting the ground for both teams? And I just really think we're going to be heavily resting on our stars to come good this week. This is the first time I feel like we really need to go out and lean on the big guns to go and get it done for us. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, no, this just has a third down to Golden Tate kind of feel to it late on Sunday night. Just has that kind of feel to it. On Kerryon Johnson, though, Rob, you're someone obviously with the blog follows, is his start to his NFL career surprised you, or is he someone you tabbed coming into the draft last year?
I absolutely loved Kerryon Johnson. There were three players early in the process who we kind of zoned in on at the running back position, kind of feeling that the Seahawks would show some interest there. The first one we talked about was Rashad Penny, but then we ended up talking a lot about Damien Harris, who's still at Alabama now and is going to be part of the draft next year. He's a very good player. He's not got any tread on his tires either, so someone's going to get a steal with him. And then there was Kerryon, and there was Ronald Jones, the second, who's having a bit of a difficult time in Tampa Bay. And Kerryon, the difference between Auburn this year and Auburn last year is probably Kerryon, because he just led that team. I know that Jared Stidham did a very good job sort of managing the game as a quarterback, and they've got a defense that it kind of, they almost have the same energy of a young sort of LOB, the way that they were playing, and there was that swagger amongst them. But Kerryon just set the tone up front. Just his patience. He has that sort of Le'Veon Bell ability to sort of just lure a defender in, wait for the gap to open up, then just explode through it. He had an incredible combine, which I think had like a 41-inch vertical, which showed how explosive he was. That combined with his patience, his power, his size, everything about him is just in the ideal kind of bracket there. The only thing that he has had is a few injury issues in his career, and we'll see if that becomes an issue for him down the line. I think he's already been a little bit banged up during his time in Detroit. I think he's had a minor injury just before this Miami game. But he's a tough physical runner, very, very good player. Thought in the second round where they got him, it was just an absolute steal. He's got the ability, and it'll much will depend on Detroit's ability to sort of stay relevant over the next few years. But he's got the ability to become one of the very best running backs in the NFL, and not a surprise at all that he's had a really, really good start.
Yeah, he's only 21 as well, so he's got a hell of a long way to go. His NFL career. Obviously, you just mentioned Golden Tate. I mean, he's one of my favourite Seahawks over the last decade or so. He's so much fun to watch. He's just a troll, an internet troll on the field for most his touchdown celebrations. And we talked a few weeks ago about the high five in the Miami game. I mean, he was the best at things like that. He is, after Kerryon, he's the guy that got probably key on after the running game, isn't he, Adam?
Yeah, he's kind of the slippery wide receiver version of his quarterback, just like does the unexpected and manages to find yards where you just can't see them. We discussed last week that Trey Flowers is playing a bit like Shaq Griffin did last year, whereby there's nothing going over the top, but it's pretty easy to complete underneath against him. I think Seth Roberts had about five catches, you know, to that
exactly
side.
Exactly the same play.
And you just worry that with Golden Tate being so good after the catch, you know, that's probably not something that we can allow to happen. So I wonder if maybe Griffin will follow him a bit, even though that's not necessarily in kind of the Seahawk mantra. But he's obviously going to be one to watch. And then Marvin Jones on the other side is also, you know, been a great signing for Detroit since moving from Cincinnati.
Yeah. But on the defensive side for Detroit, this is a quietly stacked and unheralded unit, isn't it, on the defensive side of the ball for the Lions?
Possibly so. I think just one quick other final point on what the Seahawks are going to have to do is they're going to have to tackle better on defense. Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of missed tackles against the Rams. And I noticed at least a couple of them, Justin Coleman again at the weekend, in the London weekend. And that's something that we've not really seen from him until, I think, these last couple of games. So if it is going to be all underneath, like you say, to be like Golden Tate, and why not? And he is very difficult to bring down. So you better wrap up. You better get in there and be ready to hit and make sure that they hit the turf as well, because there's some very tricky receivers and running backs that can make some plays for Detroit. I think their defensive unit, it's strange because they've looked pretty awful at times as well. Yeah. I mean, the first game sort of sticks in the mind. And I do think there's a potential there for the Seahawks to just go and play their game, run the ball, let Wilson do his thing. Wilson has looked a lot more settled in this system since the Arizona game when he was 0-for-10 on third downs. You know, hopefully the guys are a bit more healthier. Hopefully Doug Baldwin's a little healthier now. Certainly seemed that way in London. Tyler Lockett's making big plays. So there is a nice balance to the Seahawks offense right now. So I think that, you know, I would expect the offense to keep making their plays. I think you called it, though. My fear is that there's going to be some bizarre Golden Tate sort of 55 yard where 54 yards are after the catch run which ends up being the decisive thing, and he is a troll, and he's the kind of player that I think us as Seahawks fans we look beyond it because we had it for so many years, but he's that kind of player that if he isn't playing for your team you blooming hate him, but he's so much fun if he's on your team. He is a troll on the field, but he does it with some fun. I think he's the nearest thing to Hines Ward since Hines Ward, and I think he's a heck of a player, and it's a shame the Seahawks couldn't keep him.
Yeah, it is. I would happily take him back in a heartbeat. Obviously, one thing on that Detroit defensive unit was added to yesterday when they traded for Damon Snacks Harrison from the Giants for just the fifth-round pick, which is just barmy behaviour yet again from the Giants. That's as you put, Adam, that's a bit spursy, isn't it?
it's just classic. You know, no one like Spurs could have players signed for, you know, the week before you play them. Thank God for the transfer window. But do you know what? Like, if we're not going to go all the way this year, you might as well see what you've got. And if you're going to get a bit of an extra challenge up front, if, you know, this is obviously a complete offensive line rebuilding situation, people like Sweezy and Fluka, you're going to try and work out if you're going to pay them long term. I think at the minute we all think we should. And I guess I don't hate the fact that they get a decent challenge. I mean, again, that's probably not the way a fan should think in terms of, you know, well, you know, have all their players injured and win 100-0. But in the long term, it's probably best to see what we've got, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, it is. I do think some perspective is required here. This is an offensive line who did a fantastic job dealing with Aaron Donald, Michael Brockers and Ndamukong Suh 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And as good as Snacks Harrison is, he's not Aaron Donald, Michael Brockers, and Dominican Sue. So it's a nice test. I do think that isn't it weird? The NFL trade market is so weird that you can kind of just pick up a player like that on a fifth round pick, which is a round later than Eli Apple. And you see Amari Cooper's going for a first round pick. Josh Gordon's like a late round pick. You know, why didn't Dallas just go and get the guy for the fifth round pick or the conditional fifth? You know, the Seahawks can't get seemingly much at all for Earl Thomas, but Amari Cooper, who drops, you know, a pass every three targets, is a first round pick. It just seems like the value you just never know what the value is going to be. I mean, like, the Seahawks made two big trades with Dwayne Brown and Sheldon Richardson and can't give Earl Thomas away by the looks of things. So I just don't get the NFL trade market at all. And I think you have to give Detroit a bit of credit there for pulling off a good move for them, because they have been giving up some big plays in the running game. So that will help them.
Yeah, they spent an early pick on the Alabama lineman as well, didn't they, this year?
They've spent a lot of picks on, you know, because they've got A'shaun Robinson, haven't they? Yeah. They've been spending a lot of picks on Alabama defensive lineman. You know, how they managed to fudge it and lose Sue when they did, and not be able to retain him, and never, that they will never, I will never ever forgive Detroit for not drafting Aaron Donald and drafting Eric Ebron instead. I mean, they lost Nick Fairley and drafted Eric Ebron, and it was set up for them to have Donald and Sue, but instead we have to watch them play for the Rams instead. So, you know, that they could have had that, and who knows what they would have achieved if they'd actually drafted Aaron Donald like they should have done that year.
Yeah, and obviously we got Snacks Harrison's debut in Detroit this week, and then next week Joey Bosa's first game since the Alamo.
That was the most typical thing. As soon as I saw that from Schefter, first game, but I didn't even need to read the end of the article. I could have said it's going to be the Seahawks, isn't it? It was just the most obvious thing of all. The last thing we needed in a day like that is Bosa coming back, all guns blazing. But yeah, I mean, such is the way. Unfortunately, you support the same team as me, so you're going to get hosed. Just the way it goes.
So Rob, you said that this is a tough run of games, but this there's a lot to say with this, like, playoff percentage. Even at this point, there's a lot swinging on this game for both teams, isn't it? With obviously the Bears and the Vikings and the Packers for the Lions all kind of seem to be trying to cut each other's throats. It's a big game on both sidelines, with playoff implications even at this point in the season.
Well, while we're talking about Sod's Law, isn't it just frustrating that the Seahawks are in the only division with the one team that looks like they're just going to run away with the division? Like, everybody else is in. Like, the Falcons won at the weekend, they're suddenly back in it. You know, and for the division, you know, not just for the wild card. So, you know, it's a shame that the Seahawks are kind of just focusing on that wild card and don't play in a division where they could still go on a bit of a run and challenge for first and a home playoff game. But yeah, I mean, this is the doubly important thing. Having already lost on the road to the Bears and having now lost at home in another NFC game against the Rams, they can't afford to lose in Detroit and Carolina. And because then what's going to happen, even if they got to sort of 9 wins or even 10 or whatever it's going to take to get in there, if they've got a bad record against the other teams in the NFC and they're coming up against these teams for the playoff spots, then it's not going to work well for them. So I think the Carolina one might be a bit more important. I fancy them as more likely maybe to be there at the end and not necessarily a division winner that you might end up having to compete with to try and get a wild card spot than Detroit. That said, that NFC North is wide open. I mean, the Packers don't look anything with Rodgers hurt, and they seem to be in a bit of turmoil there. You know, I've seen the Clinton Dix is already talking about leaving in free agency and stuff like that. And the Vikings are a bit of a weird team this year, aren't they? I still think that they may well go on and win that division, but they are still a bit strange. And then you've got the Lions and the Bears still in the race as well. So you've got to take some wins off these teams in the NFC. So yeah, this is very important, as will be the home games against the Packers and the Vikings, and then the rest of the NFC West games, and of course when they go to Carolina.
Yeah, outside them, who thinks the most important player? Obviously, Wilson's probably high up on this, but who's someone who you're going to look out for to have an impact on Sunday, and obviously your score prediction as well?
I'm going to go with Baldwin to sort of feed off a good game in London and you know, maybe haul in two touchdowns. And I don't even know if this is possible No, it is possible. I'm going to go 23-21 Seattle. I'm probably riding on a high of what a great week last week was, and I think we probably are underdogs, but I'll go that we'll pull this one through somehow in 23-21.
Rob, same to you.
I really, really hope the Seahawks win. I really do. So I want to note that before making the prediction. But I think the Seahawks will be leading sort of 23-20, and then Detroit will score that Golden Tate touchdown late on, and it will end up being 27-23 to the Lions.
I think that happened last time in Detroit, didn't it? Didn't Matt Stafford score on a fake spike?
It sounds right.
What I remember the game, because I was actually at Wembley watching one of the London games and watching the game, the Seahawks game, on my laptop in the press area. And it was Marshawn Lynch scored a really long touchdown in
right
Detroit,
at the start.
Didn't he?
Yeah, I was in Seattle for that for some reason. Yeah, I was in Seattle. I'm almost certain it was a fake spike from Stafford, and he kind of just put the ball over the line, one of those horrific quarterback, like, just break the plane by 1 millimetre and it's a touchdown kind of thing.
And it was a game that was really winnable, if I remember. It was like they should have won it and they didn't. And there was a few question marks being asked at the time. So that was 2012, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And then it was the Chicago game, I think, was after that. And that just changed things around.
Yeah, I'm going to go 27-24. I just kind of want to see the usage of the running back position, because it's still a bit strange the last few weeks. Obviously, Carson's clearly the guy, but the second and third guy, and how Penny is brought along, because obviously he had one big play at Wembley. So just want to have a quick spin in getting a pin, Adam.
Yeah, we should do, really, shouldn't we? Be rude not to.
There's plenty of candidates this week. So get in the bin.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, as I said, there are plenty of candidates this week. Obviously, our Lord and Savior Hugh Jackson is there, even like
permanent resident. But you can't take him out. He's permanent.
After last weekend, where he's basically said he's going to start calling the plays, it seemed to catch the attention of John Dorsey. He's even more further entrenched, if that's possible. Never fire him, please, Cleveland, because lose about 10 minutes of podcast. But also for me, probably the entire Dallas Cowboys over the last few days, they deserve to get into the bin. Jason Garrett, for how he called the end of that game in Washington, was just absolutely bonkers. It was Chris Peterson in Oregon on steroids, Adam. and then obviously Jerry Jones, he runs away Dez Bryant for I'm not too sure why. Who obviously didn't look the same player he was a couple of years ago, over the last couple of years prior to that. But then he gets basically his clone in Amari Cooper, who brings exactly the same to the offense. So, yeah, the entire Dallas Cowboys organization can get in the bin, Adam.
Very good pick. I think not to criticize him, because I empathize with his position, but I don't really know what his game is anymore. Le'Veon Bell's still not turning up. And if I think I'm right in saying
6.8 million.
Yeah, he's lost 6.8 million in game checks this season, which is the highest of any running back that they would have been paid at this stage. And he's got to turn up in the next 3 weeks, because otherwise it's not going to accrue a season on his deal. So I don't know what you think might happen there, Rob, but it seems a pretty confusing play. I fully appreciate his thought process, but it doesn't really seem to have much sense anymore.
Yeah, I don't appreciate it. I think it's just balmy. I'd love to say to him, What's going on? I mean, just go. I know that he's sort of feeling like, don't play the season, be fresh, go into free agency, get paid millions. But you've lost $6-7 million. That's only going to go up. You've given everybody an opportunity to see that James Conner, who I think was a fourth or fifth round pick, is equally as productive as you've been. I mean, he's not as good as you, but he's producing within that offense. You just wonder whether teams are, I mean, what does he really expect he's going to get in free agency? You know, teams have not been spending big money on running backs. The big running back contracts have gone to players who are on existing teams like Todd Gurley already. So I really have no idea what he's thinking. For me, I just play the year, get your $14-15 million, whatever it is. And you know what? If there are injuries in football, I fingers crossed that doesn't happen to you. You may still get quite a sizable contract in the off season anyway, as long as you know your leg didn't fall off. So I just don't get the thought process. He's cost himself millions and millions of dollars, and I just don't see how that could. There's got to be other plans than that.
But I think I'm right in saying that if he doesn't turn up by week 10, they can franchise tag him again next year.
Yeah, he won't accrue this season.
Won't account. So there's no real play for him at all anymore.
No, he has to play eventually. And you would think that all he seems to have done is just pissed everybody off in Pittsburgh. The fans, the players, the team. And by all accounts, they offered him a long-term contract not so long ago, and he just said it's not enough. And you think, well, they were willing to make you by far the highest paid running back in the league. And I think he said that he wanted to be paid like a running back and a receiver because he does both. Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to get that in free agency. I mean, if he's lucky, he will get a similar contract to Todd Gurley, which may be less than what Pittsburgh were offering him in the first place. I think his issue is that Pittsburgh have a very strict policy on guarantees. So they're you know, like, and they've all got it. You know, Roethlisberger, Brown, you know, all of the players that they've ever paid in Pittsburgh all have to come under this banner, the guaranteed limit, and the team gives themselves all the flexibility, and Bell's obviously making a stand against that. But a Pittsburgh, you know, notorious for screwing players over. I mean, they've been very loyal to players over the years. And just look how loyal they are to the coaches, for example. I mean, they stick by their coaches forever. So I don't see why he had so much to fear about. And given that he's been playing the last few years anyway under Pittsburgh, you might as well just sign the deal. They weren't going to get rid of you as long as you were still producing. And it seems like, well, if you're producing, you'll stay. If you're not producing, well, you really deserve the $15 million a year anyway. So I don't really understand the thought process with that. So, yeah, I think you've picked a couple of good ones, especially with Jerry Joe. I mean, what on earth Dallas have been doing? can I just say something? Apparently they didn't want to. They were willing to trade for Earl Thomas for that second round pick, which was like 50 overall, but were just so tempted by Connor Williams, the guard, who's been an absolute disaster for them so far this year. I mean, I just wonder, did they actually ever watch Connor Williams play for Texas? what was so appealing that he was more attractive than having Earl Thomas playing safety for them this year? I mean, that just did not make any sense whatsoever, that they just thought, we've got to have this guy, and he's been awful for them. And you could see it coming a mile off. He was always really soft at Texas. He always looked like he, you know, flattered to deceive a little bit, was always a bit more athletic than anything else. He's having a horrendous year. They let Dez go. They don't adequately replace him. They could have had Calvin Ridley, but they don't go down that road. Great. Leighton Van Der Esch is a fantastic pick. Great player. Really like him. But now they're in this, now making aggressive moves at 3-4, like Amari Cooper's going to save the season. Like, that's really, yeah, he's not the issue. You know, this is, and there are bigger issues in Dallas than the lack of a guy who drops too many passes. It just doesn't, you know, if I was a Cowboys fan, I'd just be sat there going, what are you doing? You know, at least Oakland doing stupid stuff, but at least as a fan, you've got three first-round picks to look forward to. I mean, that's kind of fun. Mm. What have you got in when Dallas inevitably finish 8-8 this season? They're going to have nothing to look forward to.
Apart from a
Jason Garrett contract extension.
Yeah, I mean, is Jerry just waiting for Drew Brees to retire in New Orleans and go and get Peyton? Do you think that's the only reason he hasn't got rid of Garrett yet?
That's been talked about for ages, hasn't it? I think that Jerry, I don't think that'll happen, because I think Jerry wants to be the head coach. And as long as Jason Garrett is the head coach, Jerry kind of is the head coach. Yeah. And if he appoints Sean Payton, Sean Payton's not going to have any of that shenanigans. Yeah. So this is a situation that works very well for Jerry Jones right now. And I think that that's probably why we'll see a 5-year contract extension for Jason Garrett in the offseason.
Yeah. Obviously, one more thing we get in the bin. Las Vegas on Sunday night had the over-under on the Kansas City Cincinnati game at 55.5. And then the Cincinnati Bengals went for it on 4th-and-4 from the 5 late on. Didn't get it, and the score finished 45-10. And a lot of people, I think even Al Michaels mentioned it on the broadcast as well, a lot of people in Vegas were very unhappy. So but Vegas is good. I got stung by an over-under thing as well on college on Saturday. So Vegas is quite annoying this week. Anything else, Adam, want to mention NFL-wide?
Well, as we're here with Rob, very quick draft, you know,
quick stuff on draft. I've seen a lot of Giants fans saying, oh, you know, Saquon was the right pick because we'll get the quarterback in this draft class, which doesn't necessarily seem to be anything like or close to the truth, because Herbert was saying that he might stay back. But if you had to pick, you know, your top five now, who have you got earmarked, and or which positions do you reckon are going to go high?
Well, I don't see them having any chance of getting a quarterback unless they look out on somebody in the second and third round. My favourite quarterback, Steven Montez at Colorado, and I think the way that he's played the last couple of games, I don't see him declaring. I think he's probably more likely to come out next year. I think the same with Herbert at Oregon. So I don't see the Giants having a possibility of getting a quarterback this year in the draft. In terms of the top five players, I think you're looking at your Nick Bosa's, obviously, Clelin Ferrell at Clemson. I think Ed Oliver's probably going to end up being around that range. I really like Devin White at LSU, and I think he's going to have the kind of combine that could push him a little bit higher than linebackers usually go. I think the problem with this draft after that is that this is going to end up being a draft class where there's not going to be a great top 10. I think you might as well be picking 17th, 18th, and 7th and 8th. I think the talent difference is going to be minor. I think there's going to be a lot of depth on the defensive line and front seven, which is a good thing for the Seahawks. So, you know, they're probably going to... It's not even a problem. They will be able to draft a defensive lineman or a linebacker or a defensive tackle, whatever they want, edge, speed, power end, whatever they want to draft, they'll have a chance to do it in this draft class. They will target a guy and they'll get a guy that they like in the defensive front seven. Nailed on. But if you're a team that's bad and you're looking for that cornerstone player in the top 10, you ain't going to be able to, apart from Nick Bosa and Ferrell, you probably ain't going to find it. You're just going to have to take your best defensive lineman. There isn't a top left tackle. There isn't a left tackle, I think, that will go in the top 20. I think the first tackle that got off the board with David Edwards, who's a right tackle at Wisconsin. I think Greg Little will play guard at the next level. There's no quarterback that I think at the moment you would, unless Herbert declares and teams really like him, I don't see a quarterback in the top 10. I don't see a receiver in the top 15. I think Greedy Williams is probably going to end up going in the top 15 just because he's going to be the only one that's left. But I don't see a cluster of cornerbacks that are going to go very early. Don't see safeties that are going to go very early. It's just all defensive linemen and linebackers, which is great if you need one. But, you know, teams in the top 10 want quarterbacks. They want left tackles. They want cornerbacks. And they're not going to be there this year. So I think there's a lot of teams, that are, especially Oakland, and they're going to be looking at this draft and thinking, I wish there was a few different options there. So I think it's going to be a good draft for the Seahawks, everybody else. Deep on the front seven and not deep at all at the top level at a lot of premium positions.
Yeah, so what you mentioned Nick Bosa. What do you make of him? Obviously, for people who don't know, he's injured and he's decided he's just going to sit out the rest of the season. What do you make of that? Obviously, we saw a couple of years ago with McCaffrey skipped the bowl game. Someone else skipped the bowl game as well. But this is six or seven games he's missing. What do you make of Nick Bosa's situation?
I mean, I think it's fair enough just because he started the season and then he's had a surgery mid-season. I think if he'd have just decided, do you know what, I don't fancy this, I think that would have been different. The fact that he's actually had a surgery probably makes it different. I mean, I think the plan was that he was going to come back potentially for Big Ten championship game, something like that. That was the plan, and he's kind of just sort of skipping that now and just saying, look, I'm going to focus on the NFL. He's seen his brother have a lot of injury issues, so yeah. Probably just wants to max out that. I think he's a good enough player that teams will just sort of turn a blind eye to that because he's a fantastic talent. So I do think he's got a legit chance to go first overall just because there aren't any left tackles and quarterbacks that warrant the pick.
Yeah, obviously. Alabama and Tua, they're way ahead in likelihood of winning the playoff and obviously Heisman, aren't they, this year? So they're playing a different sport this year, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they're yet to be tested. The LSU game, I can't wait. But, I mean, I don't know if you've seen, Devin White's going to miss the first half of the LSU-Alabama game.
Because of a targeting call, wasn't
it? Because of a targeting call. But have you seen it? I mean,
it was nonsense.
It's not even it's not a vicious head-to-head hit. He kind of dives to what I think he was like pushes the quarterback. The face masks kind of touch, but it's not a dangerous play, and he's going to miss the first half of this game now, which is going to significantly impact. I always enjoy watching Alabama LSU. I think this is going to be a decent contest, a good test. Alabama usually have a game, don't they, where they kind of just have a bit of a wobble, and then often they still come roaring back and win the national championship or get there anyway. So this could be the big test for them. But got so much power, and I mean, they've got playmate secondary. Nick Niven can coach a secondary up. They've got monsters on the defensive line. They've got a quarterback, like I said, who's going to win the Heisman. They've got receivers. They've got running backs. They've got everything. So, and the other teams, Georgia's nowhere near as strong. Notre Dame, put them in the playoffs. What's the point? You know, they'll just lose the first game. You know, Clemson have got very good defensive talent, but they've got a young quarterback, and maybe, yeah, they had a real struggle, didn't they, against Syracuse not so long ago. And then there's LSU as well, and you know, LSU have done really, I think they've had a really surprisingly good year this year, but Alabama's just got a bit too much depth. So yeah, I think it's Alabama's to waltz away with this year. It's a one team tournament, really.
Anything else, Adam?
No, I think that's good. Thanks again, as always, Rob, for joining us. Much appreciated.
Yeah. So, Rob, obviously, it's like the 17th time you've been on the podcast, but if people haven't followed you or been on the blog site, where can people catch you?
Yeah, it's a great podcast. Really glad to be on it again. Really enjoy it. And, if people want to follow the blog, it's SeahawksDraftBlog.com, all one word. And on Twitter, I'll occasionally post links to the blog and a few bits and pieces about the Seahawks. That's at Rob Staton.
Cool. Yeah, so I highly recommend following Rob on Twitter and obviously the draft blog as well, especially as the college season ramps up and then it turns into draft season in the new year. Yeah, but thank you, as Adam said, Rob, again for joining us. I'm glad, quite jealous of the access and experience you had in London and Wembley. We had all the madness going on in the centre of London, but yeah, it did sound quite cool. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can on Twitter at Seahawks UK, the Possession Podcast.podbean.com. Instagram is UK Seahawkers. Facebook group is UK Seattle Seahawks fans. This has been the Pedestrian Podcast. Until next time,
go Hawks.
It was amazing. Felt like a home game. I know they were supposed to be the home team, but you know, you heard our fans. But we gave them something to cheer about, and they did a great job bringing the energy from start to finish, and we appreciate them.
It did sound like they were Seahawks fans up there. It felt great, man. I felt like we was playing at home, honestly, with the rain, the weather, and then the fans just being loud. That keeps us moving.
I felt like a home game. You know, I felt like we was at CenturyLink. You know, it was great. It was great. I didn't know what to expect coming into the game. I just knew we thought like we had to bring our own juice, but it was rocking out there, and it was pretty cool. It was cool.